House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Dr. James McDowell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Tourism. Does he stand by all of his statements and actions?
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Stuart Nash.
Yes, in the context they were given and undertaken.
Supplementary. Does he stand by his statement that, quote, there is scope for a fresh look at existing levies, end quote, and if so, does this include the international visitor levy and bed taxes?
Mr. Speaker, yes to the first answer, to the first question, sorry. To the second one, there's a whole lot of work going on in this space at this point in time, which I'm not prepared to divulge.
Supplementary.
Well, no, order. Order. I know the member cannot be required to do a yes-no answer, but I think there is an obligation for the Minister to answer in the House at least as well as he has on public radio. The member will answer the question.
To the first part of the question, yes. To the second, I have on public radio noted the fact that I'm looking at the IVL. Bed taxes, no.
Supplementary. Does he believe that increasing tourism taxes or levies would result in more or fewer tourists coming to New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, I think I've been very clear in a number of places that there are some areas of this country where the social licence was being eroded due to the fact there were too many tourists.
Supplementary. Can he guarantee that any new bed taxes would not be paid for by New Zealanders?
Mr. Speaker, as mentioned, I'm not doing any work on the government implementing bed taxes.
Supplementary. Which does he think best helps the struggling tourism sector? More tourists or more taxes?
Mr. Speaker, if it was that simple, it would be a hell of a lot easy. But I have given a number of statements around how I see the tourism sector in a post-COVID world developing, and it is not more tourists, it is higher value tourists spending more money, however, New Zealand delivering on an experience.
Question number two, Irina Williams.
Tēnā koe, te māngai o te pare. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What reports has he seen on how the economy is performing a year on from the decision to move to alert level four?
Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Well, Speaker, today is the first anniversary of the move to Alert Level 4. At that time, there was significant concern about the long-term impact on the New Zealand economy. A year on, New Zealand's economic activity is in fact in line with pre-COVID levels and well ahead of forecasts in the budget and the pre-election fiscal update. The economy is also continuing to hold up well compared to our international counterparts. In the December quarter, economic activity was only 0.9% below where it was a year ago, compared to 1.1% down in Australia, 3.2% down in Canada, 4.9% down across the Euro area, and 7.8% down in the United Kingdom.
Supplementary question. What reports has he seen on New Zealand's economic performance since this time last year?
Mr. Speaker, earlier this month, the International Monetary Fund released its latest report on New Zealand, praising the economic response from the government in the past year. They specifically commented on the size and scope of our economic support and how it helped avert a much steeper decline in economic activity and employment. In New Zealand, our unemployment rate is currently below 5% and a peak of only 5.3% to date. It will bump around a bit, Mr. Speaker, but it will be well below the near 10% plus levels we were being told about. Mr. Speaker, I can also tell the House today that the number of people on a main benefit is continuing to drop. Our figures out today show 20,244 fewer people are on a main benefit compared to the start of the year, and in just the last week of numbers, 2,388 people left the Job Seeker Support Payment to go into work.
And what has been the impact of government support on economic activity in the past year?
Mr. Speaker, a report from Statistics New Zealand released today found that 3 out of 4 New Zealand firms had received COVID-19 related financial support from the government last year. The report said the assistance was one of the key things businesses used to help stay afloat last year. Mr. Speaker, the delivery of that assistance in a timely manner ensured cash flow and confidence that was a real concern a year ago today.
Question number three, Dr. Shane Ritty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all her government's statements and actions?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes, particularly the Government's decision to incentivise investment into the construction of new homes and fund the vital infrastructure needed for new housing like pipes and transport links. New Zealand's housing crisis, as we've said many times in this House and beyond, has been decades in the making and there is no quick fix. It's an issue that will take time to turn around, but our package of urgent but also long-term changes will increase housing supply, relieve pressure on the market and, we hope, make it easier for first-home buyers.
Supplementary. Under the housing policy she announced on Tuesday, if a New Zealander has a mortgage across two properties, one which is a new build and one which isn't, will their interest be tax deductible?
Can the member just ask that question again?
Sure. Under the housing policy she announced on Tuesday, if a New Zealander has a mortgage across two properties, one which is a new build and one which isn't, will their interest be tax deductible?
Yeah, Mr Speaker, on the matter of interest deductibility, the detail of the policy is now subject to the normal Inland Revenue Tax consultation process.
Tree. Has she then received a Cabinet paper providing detailed analysis on the impact of removing interest deductibility?
Mr Speaker, I think on behalf of the Prime Minister, if the member listened to the previous answer, what we have announced is the framework and the decisions that will guide interest deductibility being removed. We now get into the detail of that through a consultation process with people affected. This is indeed the normal way in which major changes to the tax system are made.
Supplementary. Will she guarantee that no further business costs will be removed from standard expensing practices as this policy does?
Mr Speaker, I can say this to the member, that the reason that this loophole was closed was in part because those people who are owner-occupiers cannot do what investors can do in the property market. There is no intention to do that in any other industry.
Supplementary. How does she respond to Business New Zealand's accusation that the government are being misleading by characterising tax deductibility as a loophole and that there is no reason for this decision and that it will stall business investment at the worst possible time?
The Prime Minister, I reject that assertion by Business New Zealand. What I would say is that this government came in on a promise to New Zealanders to be able to fix the housing crisis. We have proposed solutions. We recognise that this is not an easy issue. It will take a long time to fix. But one of the things New Zealanders want is for first-home buyers to have a fair go. That means needing to make changes. The interest deductibility changes are part of that.
Supplementary. Can she name any one of the 17 child poverty measures of material hardship that she is targeting that is not directly affected by rising rents, and if so, which one?
Well, Mr Speaker, obviously issues of housing costs are essential when it comes to all of the measures of child poverty. That's why when we look at the top three measures above the 17, they do before housing costs and after housing costs. Clearly housing costs are a significant part of the income of families and therefore the support for children. Addressing child poverty again requires a number of different measures, some of which are about lifting incomes, some of which are about making sure more houses are built, which is part of the package announced yesterday, the day before.
Supplementary. Why then did she write and answer to written questions that none of the 17 indicators measuring material hardship are directly impacted by rising rents?
Mr Speaker, I just said to the member, housing costs are an important feature of addressing child poverty.
Question number four, Jenny Anderson.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Housing. What reaction has she seen to the new supply-side measures announced as part of the Government's housing package on Tuesday?
The Honourable Dr Megan Woods.
Mr Speaker, I've seen a range of comments about the Government's $3.8 billion Housing Acceleration Fund and other supply-side measures announced on Tuesday from a number of stakeholders, both in the media and to whom I have spoken directly. Sharma Bill Jacob said the Acceleration Fund and the Kāinga Ora Land Programme are big deals and that the infrastructure money will be welcome in many fast-growing or small communities that can't afford new infrastructure. Master Bill Builders CEO David Kelly said the government is now seeing housing as a key part of our critical infrastructure and provision for infrastructure funding to support new homes and developments is a positive step.
What reaction has she seen from local government representatives?
Mr Speaker, I saw a comment from the chair of LGNZ, Stuart Crosby, who welcomed the $3.8 billion fund and emphasised that infrastructure is key to releasing land for development. And mayors across the country have also been supportive. Auckland Mayor Phil Goff said the cost of infrastructure rather than the availability of land is the major constraint Auckland faces in increasing home building. While Nelson Mayor Rachel Rees said the announcement was a game changer and there is now a potential for a lasting solution.
What reaction has she seen from developers?
Mr Speaker, Shane Brearley from New Zealand Living said that the Acceleration Fund will help move infrastructure along at a faster pace than otherwise, which is a good thing. I've seen other comments from a developer saying the fund was a good start, but it needs to be coupled with work on planning constraints and land supply. I have good news. The supply side package we announced will work to free up land, with Kāinga having funding to undertake strategic land purchases, and by putting expectations on councils in return for funding.
Question number five, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of COVID-19 response. Is he satisfied with the management of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, and will the government set an official target of how many New Zealanders should get the COVID-19 vaccine?
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr Speaker, broadly speaking, yes. Yesterday we recorded nearly 3,500 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine being administered. That number continues to increase on a daily basis. The scale-ups continued this week. 17 additional vaccine sites have come online. We expect to have around 50 vaccination sites operating across the country by early next week. Our plan at this point of the vaccine rollout was to ensure that we were scaling up sustainably, and we're working carefully to make sure we don't run out of vaccines towards the middle of the year before we start to get the big deliveries of vaccines in the second part of the year. With regard to the second part of the question, the government's goal is to ensure that all New Zealanders who can get a vaccine have access to that vaccine by the end of the year.
Will the government set a formal target and a date to achieve that target for the percentage of the adult population to receive a COVID-19 vaccine, like 26 countries in the OECD have done? And if not, why not?
Mr Speaker, no, not at this point. Our goal is to ensure that everybody who can have a vaccine, and at this point that's the adult population, that everybody who can have a vaccine has access to a vaccine and gets a vaccine. We're working hard to ensure that they have good information so that when they are offered a vaccine, they take it. Our Tier 1 vaccine experience indicates that the take-up rate is very high, well over 95% at this point. If we continue to get that kind of take-up as we move through the rest of the sequencing framework, we'll be very, very happy.
Well, in light of that answer, why did the government set targets for the measles vaccine and the flu vaccine, and why won't it set a target for the COVID-19 vaccine?
Mr Speaker, one of the things that's better understood is around the efficacy of the measles vaccine. We know a bit more about what we're dealing with there. We know more around what's required to get herd immunity with the measles vaccination campaign. We don't yet know all of that information around COVID-19.
Okay. Why is the government not publishing daily updates of the number of people vaccinated against COVID-19 like other countries do, and will they begin to do so?
Mr Speaker, yes, the plan is certainly, in answer to the last part of the question, the plan certainly is to start releasing daily updates when we get to the point where the vaccine program is scaled up. In the meantime, we continue to release regular updates on the number of vaccines that are being administered.
Why does the latest available public information show that New Zealand has administered just 0.56 vaccinations per 100 people, while Australia has administered 1.21 vaccines per 100 people?
Mr Speaker, the key point, and we've always stressed this, is not when we start the vaccination campaign, but when we finish it. We are scaling up our vaccination campaign in a way that ensures that it is sustainable, that we won't have people standing around because they've run out of vaccines. We're making sure that people will be able to get their second dose of the vaccine 3 weeks after they get their first dose. And we're making sure that we are doing this all safely.
Supplementary. Why has New Zealand administered only 41,500 vaccines when we have a supply, according to the government, of over 300,000? And shouldn't New Zealand be going as hard as possible?
Mr Speaker, as I've indicated in my earlier answers, for the member who had chosen to listen, we're making sure that we are administering the vaccines in a way that ensures that we don't run out of vaccines towards the middle of the year. We want to scale up sustainably so that we keep scaling up, so that we're reaching a peak vaccine delivery at the time when the large bulk of vaccines will start to arrive in the second half of the year.
Question number six, Dr. Tracy McCullum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for COVID-19 response, how have New Zealand's COVID-19 health protection measures improved over the past year?
Mr. Speaker, it was a year ago today that New Zealand moved to COVID-19 alert level 4, where we would stay for 5 weeks in an attempt to eliminate the virus from our shores. A year on, we continue to deal with the effects of the pandemic, but our means of responding to the virus continue to be refined and improved over time. That's included a constant review of our testing strategy to make sure it's fit for purpose and to identify any risk in any cases swiftly and appropriately. We've got thorough and ongoing expansion of our contact tracing system to ensure that we've got the flexibility and the capacity to track cases and their associated contacts in a timely manner. And we've got regular improvement of our infection prevention and control measures to restrict unwanted transmission.
Supplementary question. What have been the key lessons learnt on improving our health measures?
Mr. Speaker, as we reflect over the last year, it's important to remember there was no rule book when we started this, and a lot was not yet understood around the COVID-19 virus. So one of the key lessons for everybody involved is that we've had to continue to be agile and responsive, open to learning new things, and honest when things haven't necessarily gone according to plan. We've always been looking for ways to continue to improve, and that's what we'll continue to do.
Supplementary. How has New Zealand's health system response to COVID-19 compared internationally?
Mr. Speaker, anyone watching the news in the evening will know that the COVID-19, the effect of COVID-19 around the world continues to be a devastating one, something that we have largely been able to avoid here in New Zealand, although we, of course, we remember those who did lose their lives to the virus early on in the pandemic. Around the globe, we see the ongoing effects of COVID-19 and the very beneficial position that New Zealand has been placed in because of our elimination of the virus. Our response has been ranked as one of the best in the world by both Bloomberg and the Lowy Institute. On an average of last year, we had the fewest restrictions and the most freedoms of any country in the OECD.
Supplementary, how have these measures benefited New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, we see on a daily basis thousands of New Zealanders going about their day-to-day lives, engaging in the sorts of activities that other people around the world dream about. Homegrown, the America's Cup, a packed Hagley Oval to watch the Black Caps. These are the sorts of events that other countries around the world simply can't enjoy at the moment that New Zealanders are able to enjoy. I do want to say, Mr. Speaker, these are not the result of good luck. These are the result of a very strong, dedicated team of public health people up and down the country who are combining their collective efforts with those of the team of 5 million to keep COVID-19 out of New Zealand.
Question number seven, the Honourable David Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Agriculture. Does he stand by his comment in regards to horticulture worker shortages? Quote, the Minister of Immigration has indicated that at this stage there is no capacity to bring in any more RSC workers, unquote. If so, has he asked Cabinet colleagues what progress has been made on the Pacific COVID safe travel zone?
The Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Mr Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, yes. In answer to the second part of the question, as Agricultural Minister, I've taken part in discussions about that in Cabinet, but ultimately, the responsibility for establishment of any Pacific bubble lies with the Minister for COVID-19 response, the Honourable Chippy.
I think if I allow that, I'm going to have to allow everyone to do it, so the Minister will correct himself.
Tipkins.
Supplementary, if the Minister has had discussions in Cabinet, has he supported any Cabinet papers this year about a Pacific Island bubble?
Sorry, has he?
Had any supported any Cabinet papers this year about a Pacific Island bubble?
Mr Speaker, I think everyone in Cabinet would like to see the bubble open as quickly as possible, but as the Minister said in his previous question, our priority is to keep New Zealanders safe from COVID, which is arriving at our border every day, and we have a responsibility for that first and foremost.
Point of order, Mr Speaker. It was a very simple question. Has he supported any Cabinet papers this year?
Yes, and the question was certainly addressed.
Supplementary question. Why hasn't he prepared a Cabinet paper this year for a Pacific bubble when the horticultural sector has been seeking such?
Mr Speaker, because the horticultural sector doesn't have a responsibility to look after all New Zealanders.
Really? Okay. What is the latest date that the government will announce a Pacific bubble to give the necessary RSC workers so that the horticultural sector can have confidence in planting crops and the process they will go through in the next year?
The member, the minister being asked the question, is not the member responsible for matters of travel bubbles.
Yes, I can understand the point that the Deputy Prime Minister is making. I will, however, take some responsibility for shortening this question from one which was much longer. And in doing that, I did give an undertaking that I would be liberal in my interpretation, and therefore I'll ask the Minister to answer the question.
Maybe ask it again so that we can...
So what's the latest date the government will announce a travel bubble with the Pacific Islands so that horticulturists can have security to know that they will have the staff for next season?
Mr Speaker, that's for Cabinet to decide.
So how will Cabinet decide if the Minister won't advocate to his colleagues that there should be a Pacific bubble?
Right, well, that question's out of order.
When the Minister said on the 17th of March that we're going to run a robust quarantine system in this country, regardless of where people are coming from, because the risks out there are so significant, the fact that we haven't been able to open a bubble across the Tasman is because there's still uncertainty around the management of COVID in both countries, then with recent announcements of an imminent trans-Tasman bubble, how has he advocated for consistency for RSC workers in a Pacific bubble to meet the shortage of workers in the horticultural sector?
Mr Speaker, I think Cabinet has been aware of the pressure in the horticultural sector. That's why they approved 2,000 workers into this country at a time when there was huge pressure on MIQ, Mr Speaker. Cabinet will make decisions around the Trans-Tasman bubble. If there's any capacity at MIQ at that point, then I'll be advocating for some of those spaces to be available.
Question number 8, Ricardo Menendez-March.
Tēnā koe, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and asks, what is her response to the findings of MSD's Experiences of Money Management in the Youth Service report that payments are often inadequate and that compulsory money management may lead to further debt, stigma and hinders our young people?
Mr Speaker, I welcome the report. The report was commissioned following the Welfare Expert Advisory Group recommended abolishing compulsory money management for young people receiving a benefit aged 16 to 19. The report provides further information on what was detailed in the WEAG report and includes the perspectives of service providers and young people. MSD is now looking at those findings and will provide me with additional advice on potential ways forward, including any operational and fiscal implications. And those will need to be worked through carefully. As indicated in the Welfare Expert Advisory Group report or Cabinet paper that followed the WEAG report, this is part of our medium to long-term plan.
Supplementary. Does the Minister believe rangatahi on the young benefit have enough left on their payment card after living costs to cover basic expenses?
Mr Speaker, I think that we've been really clear that income adequacy in the welfare system is an issue across the board. What this report highlights is that the payment card doesn't necessarily work in the way that it was potentially intended, particularly for young people.
Supplementary. What does she say to the young people who are left disempowered and with as little as $7 in hand due to the universal, compulsory nature of money management that comes from the youth payment card?
Mr Speaker, that we are doing work on this, that we've outlined a plan for addressing it. Mr Speaker, I will also note, though, that the report does say that for some young people, money management does work. The area that they were most concerned about was the payment card and the constraints of where and how they can use that. I think one of the groups in particular who was struggling with the practicalities of having a payment card were young people who live rurally.
Supplementary. What new actions in the short term will the Minister take to further lift the incomes of young people who face skyrocketing rents?
Mr Speaker, we did move quickly. So last year we increased benefits. We have indexed them to wages, and so we will see another increase on the 1st of April. That is more than what it would have been if we were still set to CPI. And we do still need to do more in the income adequacy space for those on welfare, and we're committed to doing that.
Supplementary. Will she listen to the young people and researchers in the Minister's report who called for more control over their money?
Mr Speaker, I am certainly considering the findings of the report and look forward to further advice that I will receive from the Ministry for Social Development.
Supplementary. Will she direct her ministry to stop docking young people's benefits as sanctions have been shown to be ineffective and harmful?
Mr Speaker, we have addressed two of the sanctions. One that was discussed today was the subsequent child policy and also the repeal of Section 192. And we are committed to reviewing excessive sanctions, and that is ongoing work. And as I've said, there are two that have already been addressed. That doesn't mean that there's not more to do in the welfare system to uphold the dignity of those who have to access welfare support.
Question number 9, Barbara Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Revenue, what reports has he seen about the proposed change to interest deductibility for existing residential rental properties?
The Honourable David Parker.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I've seen a number of positive reports. Commentators and economists have recognised that removing interest deductibility for investors in existing rental properties will tilt the housing market in favour of first home buyers, new housing and the wider productive economy. Greg Ninnis of Interest.co said the response was, quotes, gutsy, and the timing of making such a change is perfect with interest rates at record lows. Making this change at this time will, quotes, help ensure that those investors who remain in the market are better capitalised. The IMF had warned about the risk of unsustainable house prices to our wider economy and recommended a response that differentiated between investors and first home buyers. The ANZ have said they will now look at changing capital requirements for investors in existing homes. All of these reports give me confidence this change will result in more of our existing homes being bought by people who live in them.
Supplementary. What reports has he received from industry leaders on the change to interest deductibility rules for existing residential rental properties?
I have received direct feedback from CEOs and chairs of a number of NZX listed productive economy companies. They all congratulated the government on this change. They think it's good for the economy, good for exports and good for society. They think it will work.
True. How will the proposed changes to interest deductibility rules for existing housing benefit the wider economy?
Mr Speaker, Stephen Benny of Castle Funds was reported in the Herald as saying that international investors were previously expecting interest rate hikes by the Reserve Bank to calm the residential market. This change to deductibility rules is seen by the market as reducing the risk of interest rate hikes, which would have affected everyone, including homeowners, all of them, and exporters.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Michael Waterhouse.
Does he agree with reported comments from FinDex senior partner Scott Mason, who said in the ODT yesterday, quote, removing interest deductibility for most landlords is a significant and unprincipled amendment to the tax system? And if not, why not?
No, I think he's wrong.
Supplementary.
Question supplementary, number 10, Nicola Willis.
Supplementary.
Oh, sorry, Barbara Edmonds. Yeah.
What reports has he received on the proposed interest deductibility change as part of the government's response to the housing crisis?
Mr Speaker, I saw reports this week saying the government needed to act swiftly and decisively on the housing crisis.
That's right.
And I've seen reports from the same people this week saying the government's acted too swiftly and decisively on housing reports and that we should slow things down and keep them as they are. To do that would risk a housing bubble. The government is on the side of renters, first home buyers, owner occupiers and investors in new builds. Some people say housing costs too much but then oppose every move to address it.
That's right.
It appears highly leveraged speculators have the opposition on their side.
That's right.
Question number 10, Nicola Willis.
My question is to the Minister of Housing and asks, can she confirm that neither the final design nor the criteria for the Housing Acceleration Fund have been decided on by Cabinet? And by what date will that scheme result in a single new house being built?
Mr Speaker, with the announcement this week that we've secured $3.8 billion for the Housing Acceleration Fund 2 months ahead of the budget, we can begin engagement with stakeholders about the next steps alongside working with Kāinga Ora on accelerating their large-scale projects. As I made clear to the member yesterday, I'll be taking the final design and criteria for the fund to Cabinet by the end of June, but in-principle decisions about the fund have already been made and work is well underway to understand the pipeline of projects that could be funded. In answer to the second part of the question, as I also outlined to the member yesterday, the intent of the fund is to create build-ready land for new housing, and investments will begin to be made in the second half of this year. I expect to see new houses enabled by this infrastructure under construction in 2022.
Supplementary. Why is it that despite having 2,367 government housing officials working for her, she has failed to publish anything about how the fund will work beyond this one-sided piece of A4 paper?
Mr Speaker, there has been a all the documents that sit behind this and a substantial body of work that sits behind this work have been proactively released. I suggest the member reads them because she's clearly confused. Meanwhile, on this side of the House, we're still waiting to see a single press release from the opposition about it.
Okay. What lessons did the Minister learn from previous government attempts to invest in the infrastructure side that underpins housing?
Mr Speaker, while we were doing the work to put together this fund, we certainly looked at previous infrastructure funding attempts. In particular, Mr Speaker, as a group of ministers, we took good notice of the Housing Infrastructure Fund that was launched under the previous government. It was around a quarter of the size. It was only going to be administered as repayable loans to councils who already were reaching their debt ceilings. But Mr Speaker, one of the things that we were most interested about this and we were keen not to replicate, that this funding was never tied to any agreement by councils or developers to develop the land for housing. And Mr Speaker, one of the things that we did note, this was launched in 2016. The first project that the fund was announced a year later in July 2017, with the first funding approved another year later in June 2018, and not a single project has been completed to date.
Supplementary. Why does the government need yet another 3 months to finalise this idea, yet it was able to progress 50 pages of new tax law within 3 days?
Mr. Speaker, because we certainly don't want to replicate the debacle that the previous government did with the Housing Infrastructure Fund. Not a single project completed to date.
Supplementary. What is the basis of her claim on Monday that this scheme will result in 80 to 130,000 houses being built? And why is this any more believable than the government's back of the car promise to build 100,000 Kiwi build homes?
Mr. Speaker, I think if the member does take the time to read the documentation that sits behind this, what she will see is there is quite detailed modelling of the number of houses that may be enabled. 80 to 100,000. Furthermore, specifics are given around the large-scale project land that will be there in terms of the 18,000 of state-enabled housing and a further 11,000 of market houses. And Mr. Speaker, as for the Swipe Re Kiwi Build, as I say to that member frequently, we'll put our 794 houses against their 100 affordable houses over 9 years any day of the week.
Supplementary. Does the Minister understand there are shovel-ready community housing projects ready to go up and down the country? And why won't she use government money to get spades in the ground building those houses tomorrow?
Mr. Speaker, that member needs to decide, does she want buy-ins or does she not? She seems to criticise them when Kāinga Ora do them. I have outlined to that member on a number of occasions the programme of work we have underway with CHIPS. I am not prepared to see the 77 buy-in rate we have seen from community housing providers over the last 2 years. I know that member has an aversion to building houses because that is the party that she belongs to.
Order. I'm just going to caution the member about ascribing that sort of motive to a member.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. I seek leave for the Minister to table the extensive documentation
order. Look, the member has been around these buildings for a very long time. I'm considering whether I should... Right, the Honourable Simon Bridges, it must be Thursday again, is it? Well, I'm speaking. One of us speaks at a time, and when I'm standing up, it's me. You were speaking... it might be that my new hearing aid, but I can hear the member right up here. So he needs to learn to... No, I know the member wants to go. That's the problem. He wants to go every Thursday. And I'm just wondering whether I should reward him or not. I think I'm going to punish him by making him stay here till the end of question time. Going back to Nicola Willis's point, I think she knows she's being disorderly. If she does it again, she will suffer the consequences.
A point of order, the Honourable Jerry Brownlee.
Mr. Speaker, I think what my colleague was really asking was if the Minister has relied on some documentation for the answer.
If your colleague really thought that, she would have done it. She's been around a very long time, Mr. Brownlee. She knows how to do it, and I think when she asks for a big pile of documentation and she looks at what the Minister's quoting from, even that would be disorderly. I do. Dr. Smith, do you want to have a go?
In order. I don't think you think ministerial accountability is very important. The Minister has said that there is a heap of documents. Standing Order 386 says that where a minister quotes documents That's relating right. to public affairs, a member may, by okay. point of okay. order, require okay. the think, Minister sorry, to table
member,
the document.
Member will sit down. I saw the Minister with a very small number of sheets of paper in her hand. I think even the member's imagination wouldn't call that a heap of documents. All right? I'm going to ask the member, was she quoting from an official document? Well, that was pretty clear. Right, further supplementary, Nicola Willis. Question number 11, Ingrid Leary.
My question is to the Minister of Immigration and asks, what recent reports has he seen on the additional 2,000 recognised seasonal employer workers brought in under a class border exemption to support the horticulture and wine industries?
The Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Mr. Speaker,
Mr Speaker, I'm happy to report that 2012 RSC workers have entered New Zealand, 775 from Samoa, 70 from Fiji, and 1,167 from Vanuatu. As of Saturday the 20th of March, the last 155 of these workers departed MIQ for their places of work in the horticulture and winemaking sectors. I would like to acknowledge the considerable efforts of the industry peak bodies who have worked alongside officials to successfully bring this group across the border in time for seasonal peaks. We acknowledge the difficulties the sectors continue to face and we are in constant contact with them. The 2012 RSC workers that have been brought into New Zealand is the largest group of economic exceptions allowed to enter New Zealand while our COVID-19 border restrictions are in place. The demand for RSC workers needs to be balanced with the demand from New Zealanders returning home and other border exception requests, but we are pleased the 2,000 workers approved in December are now working here in New Zealand.
How will these workers support our economic recovery from COVID-19?
Mr Speaker, this, as I said in my primary answer, this is the single largest economic-based class border exception that the government has been able to provide to date. This is in recognition of the horticulture and wine sectors being amongst our largest export sectors, with total exports valued at $6.5 billion in the last financial year. These sectors also employ around 38,000 New Zealanders, many in regional New Zealand. These seasonal workers will enable the work to continue, that New Zealanders continue in the sector. We thank the sector for their assistance in bringing these 2012 workers in over a 3.5-month period, but we also acknowledge difficulties that they face with labour limitations.
What other exceptions, economic exceptions to our closed border is the Minister aware of?
Mr Speaker, as of the 17th of March this year, 1,577 requests for other critical workers had been approved, representing close to 6,700 workers. Workers in the research and development sector topped the list, with 1,920 approved workers, representing just under 30% of the total, while 1,348 approved workers in the primary industry sector make up just below 20% of the total. At the same time, 4,501 critical health workers and the dependents have been had their requests approved.
Question number 12, Nicole McKee.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Police and reads as follows. What actions, if any, have been taken to speed up the process for the approximately 10,000 people caught in a firearm licence application backlog?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Police, police issue online reminders to people to apply for their licence well ahead of time. Police currently have a number of licence applications to process due to both COVID-19 delays and new licensing reforms and processes. Police have brought on board more staff to help with the backlog and have been prioritising applications for those who need their licence for work and for renewals first. Duck season begins in May and police are working hard to clear as many renewal applications as possible before this time, and those who do not have their licence before the season starts can still take part if they are supervised by a current licence holder.
Supplementary. Is she concerned that current government processes are stopping firearm owners who are trying to become legally licensed from actually being legally licensed?
Well, Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, as I said, there are COVID-19 related delays, and also with the new regime that was introduced with the new legislation, a more rigorous test is taken by police to make sure that people are fit and proper people to have a firearms licence. As I said, more staff are being brought on to try and process the applications that are currently on hand, and we hope that we are able to clear that as fast as possible. As I say, if people are concerned about the upcoming duck shooting season, are able to continue to undertake that practice if they are supervised by a current licence holder.
Supplementary. Will the Minister consider providing temporary extensions for delayed licence applications similar to what was done in response to COVID-19, to assist processing licences and participation of law-abiding owners in the raw? If not, why not?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I believe that question may be based on some legal advice that the Council of Licensed Firearm Owners have had recently, and I would say to the member that though that type of measure is not possible because the types of action taken as a response to COVID were narrow and are not available to the Minister at this stage.
Simeon Brown.
When the Minister says that licence holders should apply well in advance, does the Minister mean that those licence holders whose licences expire next year should reapply now so they can take part in next year's raw or duck shooting season?
Mr Speaker, I understand that those people who have to have their licence renewed get about 4 months warning that their licence is coming up, needs to be renewed in that time frame. I understand there are some delays which are a little beyond that, but if they do want to take part, as I said, in the upcoming shooting season, then they're most welcome to continue to do that if they do that with friends with a licence.
That concludes oral questions.